Welcome to the Modern Practice Podcast, where you get a special curbside consult from the front lines of healthcare. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva, and today we hear from the front lines in Seattle, where the battle against COVID-19 is the fiercest. Dr. Christopher Kim will tell us of the protocols and strategies UW Medicine is using to treat patients of the coronavirus while keeping others safe. My colleague, Lindsay Mayer, Senior Director of Vizient's Collaborative Program, recently held a special webinar with Dr. Kim. Here's what they presented.
Vizient's novel coronavirus clinical and supply update. My name is Lindsay Mayer, and I am one of the senior directors in our collaboratives program, and I'll be your host for today's webinar. From UW Medicine, Dr. Christopher Kim is the Associate Medical Director for Quality, Patient Safety, and Clinical Efficiency. He's also Medical Director for the Center for Clinical Excellence and Associate Professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Washington. Dr. Kim is also currently serving as Medical Staff Supervisor for the UW Medicine System Emergency Operations Center and is here to really share some of the experiences being on the forefront of dealing with COVID-19. So Dr. Kim, the floor is now yours.
Wonderful. Thank you. As mentioned, I'm here at the University of Washington out here in Seattle. UW Medicine is our health system out here in Seattle, and it consists of several entities. I would just want to highlight that consists of our UW Medical Center, separated into two campuses, Montlake and Northwest. There's the Harborview Medical Center, Valley Medical Center, School of Medicine, UW Physicians, the Neighborhood Clinics, Airlift Northwest, and our partners with Seattle Cancer Care Alliance and Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center. And we've all been working together as we've been responding to the COVID-19 going on here in our community. I'd like to thank all of you for taking this time to attend this webcast, and I'd like to thank Vizient for organizing this forum for us to really come together and talk about this public health emergency together. As you know, Seattle has really been at the epicenter of this epidemic, where our Seattle King County just reported yesterday 74 new cases, bringing the total officially to 190, and two new deaths yesterday, bringing the total to 22. And regardless of really where you are in the country and how many cases of COVID-19 you've had experience with your organization, we're all really bound together now to care for our patients and our families and others in our community. And it's really a time to support our providers, staff, and colleagues in our workplace as a ripple effect of this spans beyond just the care of patients with this infection. I'd like to take the next several minutes to sort of provide you with our experience to date. Just as all of you have been doing, we've been really monitoring the events around the world related to COVID-19. Since the end of 2019 and beginning of this year, and we've activated our site-based emergency operations centers to really plan and conduct drills. But really, January 21st, when that first case of COVID-19 in the U.S. in Snohomish County, which is just north of us, was announced, it really accelerated the activities around what we needed to do. Our infection prevention colleagues, in not just within UW Medicine, but really throughout the county, are a close-knit community, and they were in communication to learn from this first case hospitalized. We increased our preparedness efforts and communicated and coordinated with public health and the Department of Health at the state level. Some examples, Harborview Medical Center was designated as the coordinating entity should any patients need to come to our system. And I think if you are part of a system, having a designated site is probably a good thing to do. We actually initiated a home assessment team under the leadership of Vanessa Macara, which was the manager of our Harborview infection prevention team. And that really was meant to provide COVID screening and testing at home so that those patients didn't need to come to clinics or the ED. And that was a really good thing to do early on, trying to contain exposure to this. Supply chain increased their stock of PPE, and I'm going to talk more about that. And we continue to monitor the situation around the world as the disease spread through Asia, Europe, and the Middle East, and then eventually to Seattle, King County. Then, as all of you know, on February 29th, just 11 days ago, there was the first death of COVID-19 patient at a hospital in one of our County King County hospitals. And the other major breaking news there was this report of residents in a long-term care facility who became ill and then subsequently diagnosed with COVID-19. And part of that story also referenced several staff and other residents becoming ill. And now recognizing that this is a full-blown disease that's communicated throughout the region, we activated our system-wide incident command center as well as all of our entity-based incident command center to accelerate and coordinate all of our activities throughout the system. We're under the leadership of Dr. John Lynch, who's our medical director of infection prevention at Harborview, and under the leadership of Dr. Tim Dellett, who's our chief medical officer of the system. We activated our COVID-19 response team, and really everybody dropped everything and came together to work on this as a unified system. It allowed us to be nimble and mobile and act quickly to develop these protocols and guidelines. I am not exaggerating when I say this. All the people that contributed to this, it adds up to thousands of person hours to develop these guidelines and protocols and algorithms. And this is part of the reason why we believe that it's important that we get this resource out there to anybody that may find it useful. And there is a link to this at the end. A few things that I do want to talk about. One is around personal protective equipment, the need for training. That became so clear up front that it's not clear that who all have been appropriately trained. And we really do need to protect our frontline care providers to ensure that they are donning and doffing properly, that they are provided with the necessary supplies to protect themselves as they encounter patients with concern or with this particular virus. Supply is going to be a challenge. We thought we were stocked, but what we quickly realized is that within the first 5 days of this, we ran through 30-day supply that we usually utilize. And so we were seeing our supplies drop precipitously, partly probably because of increased utilization, but partly supplies just disappearing inexplicably. And that warranted a tighter control to access and distribution of these PPEs. And I would encourage organizations out there to think about how you would do that right away. Establishment of a strong conservation and reduced waste strategy. Some of the things that we've done already is ensuring that only essential providers go there. That means even though education is a big mission of ours as an academic medical center, medical students are not participating in the care of these patients, and they are not utilizing PPEs for other patients where these gowns are and masks are required to go into the patient's room. That's just one example. Really making tough decisions. I think that's another aspect that we'd like to relay here from the trenches, which is that now the CDC has changed their guidelines on PPE, but really last week when we were faced with the situation where N95 masks were dissipating very quickly, we had to make a decision to go to droplet precautions and allow standard masks with face and eye protection. And we made that decision in coordination with other hospitals in our region and with the public health and be in line with the WHO and Canada and other countries. We created a document explaining our reasoning, and we rolled that out to our staff saying that their security and safety is our top priority, and there's a reason why we did this. And we're very pleased to see that CDC has also changed our guidelines to help hospitals throughout the country. So UW Medicine Clinical Virology Laboratory really was on top of this, and as this disease was going around throughout the world, they developed a PCR-based test, which was ready to go in the early days last week. Dr. Alex Greninger, who is the lead investigator for this, developed this, and now we're actually able to do hundreds of tests a day, and with plans to go to thousands of tests. We've provided this to our employees as well as frontline care providers, and we're going to offer this to local and regional community as testing increases. As Kerry and Dr. Sexton mentioned, we do have a drive-through testing clinic that was put together first for our employees. Then now it's also going to become made available for our patients as well at a different site. The structure that we put in is that an employee would see if they're eligible to have this test. They would put in a request. Somebody would reach out to them from the clinic to schedule, and they would just go through this drive-through testing, and the results are delivered within a day or two with instructions on what to do if it's a positive test. There's been testing for our patients in our clinics and urgent care that was also activated this past weekend. That's in addition to the testing that was being done at home and in ED. And as I mentioned, there's going to be testing clinics throughout or just in one site to start with. There's increased capability that we've put together around telehealth and telemedicine, and I think that's a tremendous program to activate if you have it, or if you don't have it yet, activate it. If you have it, increase the capacity to do that. We've done that for patients being evaluated at home, but also patients who show up in clinic. We can do telemedicine visits in clinic. We've made a lot of decisions around meeting restrictions and telecommuting. These have been provided through guidance at the state level, as well as the county level and at the university level. We've gone to remote classes and meetings. There's been travel restrictions put into place, certainly international travel restrictions, but now really for non-business related we are asked not to go on travel until early April, and really discouraged to even go on personal travel for the medical center staff. Another really tough decision that needed to be made was around visitation restrictions. So much discussions that happened very quickly within days. And we just went live with this today. Again, a very difficult decision, but we felt that this was in the best interests of our patients, family, community, and our staff and providers. There's activities going around, going on to communicate with our adult family homes, long-term care facilities, and skilled nursing facilities. And as there's increased cases in these facilities, we're coordinating with public health and the Department of Health and CDC to as best how to best evaluate and care for these patients and bring these patients to the most appropriate clinical care site to ensure that they receive appropriate care. Information for our staff and providers around personal and work-related or HR-related issues are constantly being developed and revised as necessary. We're sending out strong support messages and strong support program for our staff as they are at the front lines, some experiencing burnout, distress, concerns about what's going on within their family and what to do if there should be situations, as Dr. Sexton mentioned, around home care needs. We were providing guidance to our workforce for these higher risk population, those that may be pregnant, those that are immunocompromised, or those that are greater than 60 years of age with significant medical comorbidities. Communication is so critical. Everybody is hungering for information, and information needs that needed to come out an hour ago. People are clamoring for and asking for. And so coordinated, timely communication is critical. We've held town halls and will continue to have town halls. Communication cascading down through multiple channels to ensure it gets to those providers and staff that need to be aware. We're providing reports and have created dashboards that provide information such as number of days of PPE on hand to help us decide what to do next in terms of our care plan needs, as well as other conservation and reducing waste strategies around PPE. We have information around who's been tested, how many have tested positive, negative, what the current status of these patients are at each of our medical centers, and to be able to see that across the system has been tremendously helpful. As I said, well-being of our UW Medicine community is something that we've really kept our pulse on, and beyond peer support, in-person, there's consultations through virtual sessions, group support sessions through virtual meetings, and even a town hall for peer support. Again, planning for increased activities related to COVID-19 is going to be something that we'll need to continue to struggle through. What we've learned is that really, we are a strong and supportive and collaborative organization and community. And what we've experienced and we'll go through is going to be difficult, and we've gone through difficult patches, but we're going to persevere through this together. And I just want to encourage all of you out there to prepare and collaborate and support each other, because this is going to be something that's not over tomorrow or next week, but probably something that we'll need to deal with for months ahead. We are here to be partners with all of you and be helpful to all of you in any way that we can. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Kim. So let's go ahead and move to Q&A here. We got a lot of questions coming in. And the first question for Dr. Kim at Washington, I think there's been some information that has been shared about the University of Washington or UW-Medicine accessing the national stockpile. And we were wondering, can you speak a little bit more to this? Maybe share your experience if you have any additional information about how UW accessed this stockpile, this national stockpile.
I could try my best. Our supply chain, our planning logistics folks are not with me right now, and happy to follow up with any follow-up questions. But essentially, the process was we made a request to the state, who in turn had been in communication with the federal government. And once those supplies arrived at the state level, then we needed to make a case for why we needed to access those supplies to the state. And having information such as how many patients are we taking care of, how many do we anticipate taking care of, how many patients were under the rule-out category or under investigation, and our use rate, those kinds of data was important in being able to access the national stockpile that was sent to the state and then is eventually getting it here.
Great, thank you. And let's see, looking through some of these questions, are there any recommendations for differential handling of the deceased that have tested positive or were suspected for COVID-19?
Yes, we do have a policy that was drafted with our autopsy and after-death services group. And essentially, the process calls for notifying the county medical examiner, but they will actually not be picking up these bodies. We will not be doing autopsies on these COVID deaths. We're going to try and obtain swabs either before or immediate or just soon after the death if it wasn't obtained before the patient passed away. They are working with funeral homes and cremation societies to determine the transfer process of that body. And there's a lot of other details that have been laid out by our autopsy and after-death services, which we're happy to share as well.
Great, thank you. Is there study information or information about how long after contracting the virus one can still be a carrier or contagious?
I think that's not exactly known, but we have developed guidance for our staff and employees and providers who had contacts with patients under investigation or with confirmed COVID, as well as staff and employee who've been tested positive for COVID.
Any recommendations for PPE for those on BiPAP?
BiPAP, if it's considered an aerosolizing procedure, which I'd have to look up whether that does fit into that category or not. But the general guidance is that any procedure that may cause aerosolization should have N95 with face shield and contact isolation, or the use of a PAPR rather than the use of a regular mask.
Thank you. And let's see, we do have a couple questions about how long the virus stays on a surface. And I think some information out there might be conflicting. Some information I've heard a couple hours, but Dr. Kim, anything, any additional information you've heard about how long the virus can live on surfaces?
I think that would probably be a more appropriate question for our infection prevention folks, but what we've done here is that after a patient with concern for the COVID is seen in clinic, we don't have another patient go in there for at least another hour. What we've been told is that it needs to allow for at least 6 air exchanges, and that is something that you may need to work with your hospital maintenance team to determine what is the air exchange rate. But we're essentially saying 1 hour, and for certain instances, for patients with specifically COVID positive, I believe we're doing 2 hours. So that's the general guidance which we're following.
Great, thank you. And then Dr. Kim, I know you had mentioned about some partnerships with and communication to long-term care facilities and SNFs. A question came in, how should post-acute care providers best prepare for testing and possible outbreaks? So any insights to those conversations that you've had with post-acute care facilities at your organization?
I think that we'll also have some guidance on that posted on our resource site, although I don't think they're currently posted. But our current conversation is to work with our King County Public Health officials. If there's any concern of a large number of residents in a particular care facility that needs evaluation, we actually have the county-based Disaster Management Center at our Harborview Medical Center. And so they help triage how these patients evaluated. So for example, at a couple of the long-term and post-acute care facilities where there's been a large number of residents who've become ill, we've partnered with the public health as well as, in some cases, CDC to actually go to those sites, obtain tests on those patients, see which patients need to be transferred to the acute care facility. We've brought over some of those patients to one or more of our hospitals within the system, and then we'll also report back on those test results that were collected. And I think that in terms of how patients move to post-acute care facilities after they get discharged, if the patient's not symptomatic, then there's absolutely no indication for testing based on our current understanding, although those things can change over time. And having an ongoing conversation, active dialogue with your post-acute care partners. So we have a post-acute care network where several organizations around us are setting accept patients from our hospital, and we've had proactive conversations with them about what it means.
Great, thank you. Dr. Kim, any visitor restrictions to either Washington or Harborview currently?
I think this is a topic that is something that everybody has to address sooner or later. We've had really tough discussions around this because our philosophy has always been around patients are first. And we've actually had probably one of the loosest visiting policies up until this time. But as of today, we have a pretty strict visitor restriction policy that was implemented across all of our system. This is one of the benefits of creating a system-wide incident command center to make decisions across the system. And so we're all aligned in this together. So across all of our hospitals, we rolled out a strict visitation policy with exceptions, of course.
Great, thank you. Dr. Kim, we had a specific question about what is the process being used in your drive-through testing area? And then to follow on, they wanted to know, are you currently utilizing telemedicine for COVID-19?
I'll answer the second question first. So telemedicine for COVID-19, absolutely. We are utilizing it, and we're ramping up our capacity to do that, capability to do that very quickly to not just make it available to primary care, but also our specialty care providers who are taking care of some of the highest risk patient population. And so we're actually very close to getting almost all of our primary care providers credentialed in delivering telemedicine. And as I also mentioned, if patients should show up in the clinic, we're also creating a mechanism for providers to be able to evaluate patients via telemedicine, even at the clinic site. So I think all of those should definitely be explored and accelerated if you already have a program. With regards to the drive-through testing clinic, currently it's available to our employee, staff, and providers, and then also to our first-line responders that are going to see these patients in the community or in care facilities. And so the process is you have to submit a request to be tested, and that is based on some eligibility criteria that we put together as a guide. And then you submit this request, the clinic reviews it. And this is very real time. The clinic reviews it, contacts you to set up an appointment to come to this designated drive-through clinic. Once you have an appointment, you go there. I was talking to a colleague who got tested. He said, really, it was just a few minutes of waiting behind some cars. You go through, it's your turn, you roll down your window, and the tester takes a sample, and then you're on your way. And we're also going to roll out a similar process for patients. Clearly, the patients need a provider's order or a referral to be sent to this clinic. And so we're working through those logistics as this gets implemented this week.
Okay, thank you.
Powerful look at what's going on in Seattle. I want to thank Lindsay Mayer and Dr. Kim for joining us in this important and timely episode of Modern Practice. I hope this glimpse of what this leading organization is doing to battle COVID-19 will both inspire and inform you on your own efforts to deal with this virus. Please join us for other podcasts on the Vizient Medical Leadership Channel. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thanks for listening.